Welcome back to the Path of Longevity show, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Steven Sidaroff.
Today's guest I'm especially excited about. He's board certified in family medicine and founder of a website which is one of the most visited natural medicine websites in the world, and also the author of many best-selling books, Dr. Joseph Mercola. Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here, Rob. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and we appreciate the time you're taking to help us educate the public. And to get us started, it would be great if you can tell us a little bit of how you got into the area, what turned you on about doing stuff on longevity.
Sure. It's always been a fascination of mine. And that's one of the reasons why I went to medical school, because imagine I wanted to get people healthy and well, not to treat disease like almost all my other classmates did. And that was fine if that was what they wanted to do, but I was interested in keeping people healthy. I was one of the only people in the class that had that perspective. So I've always had that passion. The problem is, as you well know, I mean, at least Rob going to medical school, they don't teach you how to do that, because in 1910, thanks to Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, who actually died not too far from where I live, worked with Carnegie to initiate the Flexner Report, which literally changed American medicine forever and made it more of a pharmaceutically based component. So we were all brainwashed with that indoctrination when we go to school, and we really have to take independent efforts to acquire the knowledge to understand the true biology of how your body functions in order, if you're going to optimize health and prevent disease, because conventional medicine doesn't understand in any way, shape, or form. They only prescribe symptomatic band-aids that invariably shorten your lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we dive into this, and I'm really looking forward to it, maybe we could take a moment and just sort of step back and give us your kind of conceptual framework of aging and longevity. In other words, why do we age? What causes it from your viewpoint?
Well, it's a long, complex question. It's a long, complex answer, of course. I'll abbreviate it because of the time constraints. But from my perspective, I believe it's foundationally related to optimizing mitochondrial function. The mitochondria, of course, are the powerhouses of the cell, where they're believed to be primordial bacteria that somehow hybridized into our cells. And we have quite a bit of them. Do you know how many do we have? How many mitochondria do we have in our body?
Good question. At least tens per cell or hundreds per cell?
Yeah. So that adds up if you count the cells. So we're looking at not trillions, certainly not billions, not trillions, but quadrillions, like 40 quadrillion. So some cells, especially in the certain section of the brain, substantia nigra, can have up to 2 million of these mitochondria, because the energy dense, any tissue in your body that requires much energy requires mitochondria, because they produce this. And in fact, an interesting book by Nick Lane cites that the human body, and I think our cells produce are 10,000 times more energy dense than the sun, which is profound. So if you're not creating energy, you're just not going to stay alive very well, because all the processes that you require for life are impaired. So I really think and that relates to usually excess oxidative stress, which is one of the things I want to talk about that is not widely known or appreciated. So I really focus on strategies that optimize mitochondrial function. And usually that's, interestingly enough, pretty simple and basic, because, you know, we've all been around long enough to realize that, staying healthy is foundationally pretty simple. And it really revolves on principles to replicate what our ancestors were doing prior to us achieving the convenience of modernization, but that convenience comes with a lot of downsides that you invariably most of the time contribute to the shortening of our lifespan. Mm-hmm. So, and interestingly, a lot, and you know, we're all interested in longevity. Do you know what happened to the lifespan of the people that live in the United States in the last year. Now, if it changes and goes down by 0.1 or 0.2 years, that's considered really significant. What happened in the last year? What happened to our longevity?
It actually shortened for the first time in recorded history.
The biggest drop. How much did it drop?
I don't know.
It was a couple of years.
2 to 3 years. Years. That's a whole other conversation, but you know, it's just an acknowledgement to the point that once you start violating practices that are intrinsic to the way our ancestors lived, you're going to have complications. And we made some big violations last year or two that contradicted that strategy, and we're paying the price. So it moved us backwards. We've never had a drop like that recorded, I believe, in at least 40 years or longer. So anyway, that's a tangent, but you know, hopefully that answers your question.
Well, yeah, I just want to follow up on that if I could. Then just to underscore the notion of returning to ancestral factors, I guess. And it's several people pointed out that, you know, the 20th century was a time of exuberance about scientific development, and there was great faith in technology with, you know, landing on the moon and nuclear power. And we got a few things right, but it seems like, in the opinion of a lot of people, one thing we got wrong was nutrition. And in some ways that started us down on this pathway, but we can talk more about that later. Excuse me, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We talk about this decrease. A lot of people attribute it to COVID, but would you disagree with that? Or do you see other factors other than COVID?
Well, it's clear to me after analyzing this data for a few years that it's not due to COVID, other than the fact that it was the COVID jab that contributed to it. COVID almost had nothing to do with this. The average age from someone who died from COVID, the infections or SARS-CoV-2, you know what the average age was? 85. Mm. 85. That is beyond the average life expectancy. So if anything, COVID would have increased the life expectancy, COVID deaths. No, it was a jab. There's no question.
And additionally to that, you can see the numbers that we're in the largest obesity epidemic in the United States and worldwide in history. More than half the people are overweight or obese. We're in the largest diabetes epidemic in the United States and worldwide in history. And all those things drive the chronic diseases that
those are symptoms. Those are symptoms.
Yeah. Symptoms, and right.
There's many, this is, which leads into the first point I wanted to discuss, because there's a lot of confusion on this. And I did read your new book, the lies they told me in medical school, or was it
the lies I taught in medical school? It's right.
Oh, the lies I taught. Okay, it's even worse. Lies I taught. So it's a good book, but I really appreciate all the time, effort, and energy you put into this, and really the journey that you took, because it's pretty rare for a hardcore academic like yourself to convert over to the truth of biology. They just don't get it. I don't know the reasons for that, but you're an anomaly. So thank you for making that shift. But the omission in that book, and in most books like yours, is that the focus is on insulin resistance. And there's no question insulin resistance is an issue, but the common belief is that it's mostly sugar that's contributing to that. And sugar is a minor player, an absolute minor player. And in fact, we need carbohydrates. A low, and I'm a big fan of ketosis and intermittent fasting and even regular fasting for people who are overweight. But the real driver, from my perspective, reviewing the literature, is not the sugar. It is the fat that we're eating. In some ways, the low-fat diet of the 50s, which caused just enormous tens of millions of deaths, maybe probably hundreds of millions worldwide, because of the mistake they made, in some ways it was good because low fat is part of the solution, but it's a specific type of fat. It's the omega-6 fat, the polyunsaturated omega-6s, commonly derived from seed oils or vegetable oils that they're called, which is they try to pretty it up because vegetables have a good perception of health, but it's really seed oils and nuts too, for the most part. But these seed oils, 80% of the fatty acids in them is a fat called linoleic acid. And because it's a polyunsaturated fat, it's very susceptible to oxidation. And this oxidation generates, the fat itself isn't dangerous, but when it gets oxidized or damaged, and things that would oxidize it would be like light could do it, or pressure, or excessive oxygen. And this is, it generates toxic metabolic byproducts, which cause free radicals and then damage your tissues, like your cell membranes, your DNA, your proteins, stem cells, mitochondria would probably be one of the most important ones. And there's a very specific fat that's only available in your mitochondria. And I'll bet you know what that fat is, Rob. What do you remember that, what that fat, they call that fat?
In the mitochondria, no.
Yeah, it's called cardiolipin. Cardiolipin is the, and we've all seen pictures of the mitochondria, and they've got these little curves in them, right? And that curve is the cristae. And that the reason that curve occurs is because of a very specific fat called cardiolipin. And the only place in your body it's in is in your mitochondria. And the reason that's important, because if you don't have that curve, these complexes that cause your mitochondria to produce the energy, there's five of these complexes, they become separated. The curve pushes them together, and it makes the transfer of the electrons and the production of ATP much more efficient. So if you make, and if the cardiolipin is, instead of a triglyceride, it's like a quadriglyceride, because it has like four tails of fatty acids that, and these fatty acids are composed of fats that are common in your diet. And if your diet is composed of a high level of this omega-6 fat, it saturates this cardiolipin with the linoleic acid. And that's just like, it's like tinder in a fire. It's like that you make kindling. To start a fire. It's just, it's like ready to explode. And then there's certain items in, which is another issue. I don't know if I have time to talk about it, but iron, when you get like, is real common. When people have high levels of iron, we get iron and high levels of linoleic acid. It's just it's a recipe for disaster. And then it causes all this metabolic dysfunction. So, probably wonder, well, you know, we all know seed oils are bad, but the problem with it is that we don't know the prevalence. So, and I mentioned earlier that, you know, my focus is seeking to replicate ancestral patterns. And if you go back to 1860, you'll find that the amount of linoleic acid in our diet, this is a really important number, was between 1 and 2%. 1 and 2%. Now, omega-6s and linoleic acid specifically is considered, although I disagree with it, to be an essential fat. I consider it to not be an essential fat because newer studies prove it. I mean, you could have like few generations of animals without any omega-6 and they do just fine. But it's almost impossible to become deficient in omega-6 fat because almost every food you have has it in it. I mean, you'd have to have some industrially processed diet to have a diet devoid of omega-6. If you're eating any food, you're going to get it in there for the most part. So 1 to 2% before 1860. 1860, they developed a technology to process, industrially process seeds. And that's a long story we don't have time to go into. But in another 40 years or so, up until 1900, then they started to emerge to become pretty popular. Because even up to 1900, it was a very low amount. Before 1860, 0% of omega-6 industrialized seed oils in diet. And after 1860, we went up to 1900, went about 1 to 2%. But then, and it's been rising ever since. And I'm going to tie this into obesity in a moment. So if it was 1 to 2% in 1860, what do you think it is today? 1 to 2%.
It's orders of magnitude more.
Yes, that 100% correct. 10, 20, a minimum of 20% and as high as 30%, depending on what you're, you know, which population you're looking at. So when you get levels 10 times higher, it's an absolute prescription for disaster. And I'll tell you one of the reasons that it contributes to obesity And one of the, you know, we used to think, and I'm sure this is a factor, I used to teach that if you're insulin resistant, you are metabolically inflexible. And let's get the numbers too, because there was a study that was published in July of 2022, Journal of American Cardiology, that was an update of the previous study that was done on NHANES data that showed how many people in the United States are metabolically inflexible. And by metabolically inflexible, I mean they've lost the ability to seamlessly convert or transition between burning carbohydrates as their primary fuel and burning fats. So what do you think that number is? And this was based on NHANES data from 2018, so it's already 4 years old.
Well, I know that study. It's 88% or metabolic.
No. That was the 2000. That was the
2012 or 2016 one. Okay.
That was the previous one. You're right. It was 88%. So what did it climb up to?
What is it now?
93%. Now, folks, that's 14 out of 15 people. And that data is 4 years old. And Rob, you just cited the study before that was 88%. So that in 4 years, it went up 5%. So most likely it's over 95%. So 19 out of 20, today, 19 out of 20 of us are metabolically inflexible. We're metabolically injured. We are far from optimally healthy. That is a shocking number. So what do I believe is the primary contributor of that? There's a lot of factors, but I really believe it's this linoleic acid. There's like little to no doubt in my mind that this is one of the big things. And I'll tell you how it does it at a metabolic level. I just skimmed over the molecular biology of it. But when you get down to some other mechanisms and just what it does to your appetite. Now, there, linoleic acid happens to stimulate the endocannabinoid receptors. That's what it does. So what does that mean? Well, we have these receptors in our brain that we have endogenous opioids that can be triggered, and that's normal and healthy, because if we don't have them, we're going to lose our mental resiliency. But they can be distorted by eating lots of linoleic acid. And linoleic acid does something very similar to what cannabis does. So we're all familiar with those who either smoke or eat cannabis and they get the munchies. Well, this is because it's stimulating these receptors. Well, linoleic acid does the same thing. And there was, in fact, a drug that came out that was used to treat obesity and it blocked these receptors. I think it was called Rimonavan. And it very effective. It was like a miracle for weight loss. It consistently and routinely dramatically reduced people's weight. The only problem is a big portion committed suicide. So they had to take it off the market. So that's the mechanism that contributes to this increase in appetite. In addition to, of course, the linoleic acid will by it in and of itself will increase insulin resistance. No question about it. And I just don't have time to go into the mechanism for that now, but it increases insulin resistance. And it doesn't mean that if you are one of the 19 out of 20 people in the US who are overweight or diabetic or pre-diabetic or have metabolic syndrome, that you shouldn't restrict carbohydrates initially. I'm a big fan of that. I think there's value to that. But if you're not paying attention to your omega-6 fat, like so many people did when they were doing keto, you know, if it was fat, it was fine. Nothing could be further from the truth. They were eating seeds and nuts, and there's only one nut. There's only one nut that is not extraordinarily high in either omega-6, carbs, or oxalates. Do you know what that nut is?
This is an macadamia nut.
You got it. I know you would have it. That's 100%. It's macadamia nuts. That's really the only nut I think that should be taken or consumed in any reasonable quantity. That doesn't mean you can have one or two almonds, but almonds is one that has all three. It's high in carbs, it's high in oxalates, and it's high in linoleic acid. And people are drinking almond milk through the roof thinking it's a healthy thing. It's not. Yeah. It is not. So
I totally agree with what you're saying. I want to get into this further, but just to back up and underscore what you've said, thank you for the plug for my book. And I do agree with you. I have a confession to make to everyone here. I am a recovering processed junk food addict. And the two biggest things that processed food have that drive my addiction are refined carbs and sugars, basically, and then seed oils and the linoleic acid. And it's funny, that's what makes processed foods processed. And I totally agree with you on that, Joe. It's a great thing. I thought you were going to tell the story of the German submarines and Crisco oil.
No. I mean, but it's just huge. And most people don't get it. And you know, you can do the keto and stuff, and so a lot of the other useful strategies. But if you're not obsessing about this, and I really believe you need to obsess. And here's another reason why it's so much more dangerous than the carbs. Because if you have a carbohydrate and you go on a binge and you have a lot of sugar, you know, just pure sugar, not the seed oils, you know that that's going to spike insulin, and it'll spike your sugar and secondary spike insulin, but then it's gone. It's not staying around. It is gone within hours, day at the most. How long do seed oils stay embedded in your cell membranes? What is the half-life of a seed oil that you
for
just
years, discussed? Right? Years,
yeah,
right?
Year. Over 650 days. So literally, it's going to take you 7 years to get it out of your body. 7 years.
Maybe Joe, at this point, if you don't mind, just for our audience who's listening now, some people may know what seed oils are, but it's a little confusing. Like which there's some oils that are much worse than linoleic acid. If you could go through that,
Actually, the simplest way to do is to go to my site, we basically had to remove all our articles. My site's been around for 25 years. Most people know that. We had to delete 15,000 articles in August of 2021. And so now we have a Substack site where all those articles are. And you can just go to that Substack, just type in Mercola and seed oils, and you'll find I'm plugging my site, but I'm plugging it to give you information that I can't easily describe on this podcast. So we just type in that, and you'll get an article that has beautifully illustrated graphs of the different types of seed oils, and not only the grass, but the concentration of the linoleic acid in each one of those, like sunflower, safflower at the top. And then some people think olive oil is like a magic bullet and it should, you know, you can't have enough of that, or even avocado oil. And I got to warn you about those. Yes, they're lower on the list, but that's if you get the real deal, pure stuff. 80% of both olive oil and avocado oil are adulterated with seed oils. So it could be worse. So now if you're not spending $40, $50 a quart for this stuff, you're probably not getting the right thing. You have to get them to specialty stores, and you have to be really diligent about getting the real deal. But even if you're doing that, I still think most of us don't benefit from having that. Yes, you can have, if you have the real deal, a tablespoon a day of olive oil or avocado oil is fine. But normally you want to avoid those, primarily because of the alteration issue, but it's still high in linoleic acid. So what do you use? Because we do need fat in our diet, no question. You need really saturated fat is what you need. And saturated fat has been vilified. I can remember when Oz first made on the show, like in 2012, and that we had a contention, we had an argument about this, because he's, of course, a cardiologist, and he was a big believer in the evils of saturated fat. But I think more of us have come to appreciate that it is healthy. So the saturated fats that are healthy and low in linoleic acid are mostly animal fats. There's two primary ones. One would be ghee, which has a much higher smoking point, so it's much better for cooking than butter. But you can use regular butter too. They both have about the same amount of linoleic acid, because the only difference between the two is most of the proteins removed in ghee. And then the other one would be beef tallow. A lot of people use lard, but the reason you want to stay away from two animals that are typically perceived animal foods as healthy is that they're relatively high in linoleic acid. That would be chicken and pork. Ancestrally, they weren't, but 1860, we got the ability to industrialize the food supply. So they're now fed these seeds and grains. And for the most part, they only have one stomach, so they're just like us. They're monogastric, and if you have multiple stomachs, like a ruminant, like a cow or a deer, buffalo, lamb, then you have like a biohydrogenation chamber, so that you can take an unsaturated fat like linoleic acid, and you can actually add hydrogen bonds to it, which we can't do. really well at all. So if we can't do that, we store it. So chicken and pork, you really do want to avoid. Even if you're raising them yourself, it potentially could be okay, but you had to feed them special. You have to be completely different. You can't, if you give your chickens organic chicken food, you know, or poultry meals, it's going to be really high linoleic acid because they animal science is even worse than human science. That they don't understand linoleic acid. I view it as a contamination. I view most linoleic acid in excess of 2% of your total daily calories as a metabolic poison, and a pure metabolic poison. And I just avoid it like the plague. I try to have as low linoleic acid as I can because I just understood this about 2-3 years ago. So I still have more than I need, would like it in optimizing my cells and trying to get rid of it. And it's a slow process. So, I think that covers it because I want to go, and we have a limited time. I want to go over a few other important topics. I think.
Oh, yeah. So in addition, just to sort of wrap up the omega-6 fats and linoleic acid also, as someone who wants to avoid the downside of those with the inflammation, et cetera, so I avoid the compounds, the seed oils that have high linoleic acid and other foods. Are there any other actions I should take as far as the linoleic acid aspect of it?
Well, the simplest one is to make the conversion. And anyone who's watching this, who doesn't admit that they were addicted to processed foods like you, like me, then you're probably telling yourself a fib because all of us were. I mean, there's probably a few people out there, probably a handful, who had like wonderful parents, understood this from day one. My parents certainly didn't. And so you had to learn it yourself. And even when you learned it yourself, I mean, I didn't really fully appreciate this until really a few years ago. And I had a pretty healthy diet, but you know, you just can't, you really should not have processed foods. And the major, I mean, no one will disagree that even conventional medicine doctors know that processed foods are harmful for you. And they most physicians that are naturally oriented will think, well, it's a sugar. But if you look at processed foods, there's usually twice as much seed oils as there is sugar. You know, I already mentioned the time factor. So you got to eliminate all processed foods. I mean, that is your goal. You just, if it's in a package, for the most part, you don't want it. And, you know, so about 2 or 3 years ago, I just eliminated pretty much everything, you know, all processed foods. I mean, if it comes in a package, I mean, sometimes you have to have it come in a package. Like if you're ordering macadamia nuts, like 10 pounds, you know, it's going to come in a bag, right? It's not like, it's not processed. So, you know, so so seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, you know, these are ostensibly viewed as health foods and they're not. Now you can have a teaspoon or a tablespoon. You're going to be okay. You just don't want them in large amounts. So there's an app to sort through this. And it's called Chronometer, chronometer.com. It was actually developed by an anti-aging guy who's just passionate about health. And it's really the best calculator app out there, and it's free. And you could, if you're really careful about entering your data, like with a electronic kitchen digital scale, and you could enter it in there, and it will tell you to the tenth of a gram how much linoleic acid you're getting. And I had Aaron, who's the developer of the site, integrate a omega-6 calorie clock in there. So it tells you precisely what percentage of your diet is omega-6 calories. So it'll give you, is it 2%? Is it 15? Is it 30? Is it 40? You know, remember, it should be under 2%. Really, really hard to do. So, you know, if you're curious, you can figure it out for free. And then you'll not only figure it out, you can click on the omega-6 fat thing, right click on it, and it will show you in descending order, the highest levels of omega-6 fat that you are currently eating. So you'll know exactly where your hidden sources of omega-6 are, because no one's going to tell you. You got to figure it out yourself. You have to, really, it's your responsibility. You are your own doctor, ideally. And you hire your physician as a consultant. He or she is your consultant. They are not your dictator or gateway to health.
Those are very good points there. Thank you. We're talking on the micro level. Let's see if we can just for a moment shift to the more macro. And you're talking about mitochondria and its role in producing energy. I approach this from a different direction on resilience, behavioral mm-hmm. resilience. And I'm wondering how you see that playing a role in the work that you're doing, or how you the picture that you see.
Well, it's not a goal that I seek to achieve. It's sort of an artifact or a side effect of doing the right things. But you're right. Your resiliency goes through the roof, your ability to recover from the life's ups and downs and stresses. So that's a side, the benefit of doing this type of program. And one of them is eliminating omega-6. That's and then the other one is getting into the sun. And you're going to say, well, that's going to cause sunburn and skin cancer. Well, you know, probably one of the biggest contributors, the biggest contributor to skin cancer. Do you know what it is? It's omega-6 in your diet. That's what's causing skin cancer. It's not the sunshine. The sunshine is just the catalyst. But it's like, you can't, if you fire a gun and there's no bullet in it, it's not going to do a thing, right? Well, the bullet is the omega-6. That's what the omega-6 is. So you don't want to put that in your skin. In fact, your likelihood of getting sunburned reduces dramatically once you start reducing your omega-6 content. You just probably won't get burned again. Now you can, but it will be radically reduced. And instead of getting burnt, you'll get tanned, which is what your body needs. So that is one of the other primary strategies I widely embrace and encourage people to consider adopting, is to get into the sun an hour a day, every day, around the timing is so important. Now, you can do sunrise looking and sunset, but if you want to get the metabolic benefits from the sun, you need to get out there around solar noon. And for when we're a daylight savings time, which is the summer, that means it's 1 p.m. for most people, not 12 o'clock. So, and then, you know, so it's either from 12 to 2 is your window. And then with minimal clothing, because why? The obvious one is you're going to increase your vitamin D. I have not swallowed vitamin D in 15 years. Do you know what my vitamin D level was this year? I hit a threshold that I never thought I would hit without any supplements for 15 years. Guess what I hit?
What was it? I don't know. Yeah.
100.
Really?
I got 100 without taking any supplements.
Do you use a sunscreen?
No, it'll be silly in the sunscreen. Now, there are appropriate times where a sunscreen is indicated, but you have to use it carefully. You don't want to use it. If you use a sunscreen, you're not going to get vitamin D anyway. But the skin on your face is pretty thin and it's sensitive to photoaging. So I would keep wear a nice broad brim hat so that you don't have the sun. You want your face always in the shade. Would be best, but the rest of your body, you know, take off your shirt, wear a sport bra if you need to, and shorts, and get out there. And it's going to be but so it's not just vitamin D. There's like five other things that make a big difference. Now we all know what's important for sleep is melatonin, right? And your body makes it, but in the pineal gland. But where is more melatonin made than the pineal gland? Because the pineal gland only makes 5% of your melatonin.
Skin.
No.
The skin? No.
Nope.
Okay.
You're going to like this, Steve and Rob. 95% of the melatonin in your body is made in your mitochondria. Your mitochondria. But not indiscriminately, it's made when it's exposed to near infrared radiation. Guess which wavelength happens to be the most predominant one in sunlight? Only 7% of the sunlight is UVB or UV. It might just be UV. I don't know, but it's only 7%. So that's a relatively minor percent. 40% is near infrared. 40%. So you would think that if 7% makes vitamin D, if something that has more than five times, almost six times as much energy in it, that it might be important for human biology. Well, it is, you know, and melatonin, I believe, is the most supreme antioxidant in the body. Now, some people might dispute and say it's glutathione. Well, what does melatonin do? It spins off glutathione. But this is the beauty of the way the body's made. Your mitochondria are making the melatonin. What spins off most of the free radicals in your body? The mitochondria. That's where all the damage occurs in the microbiome. So I talked about cardiolipin. So you got to keep it low in linoleic acid. So if you're, if you would need an antioxidant to stop this free radical production in the energy producing cells or modules of your body, wouldn't it be nice to have this antioxidant there? And that's what your body does. It makes the melatonin right where it needs to be, because some of the, like the most dangerous pernicious free radical is hydroxy free radical, only lasts a billionth of a second. So there's no way in the world to effectively get antioxidants down there. It would take minutes, hours to get there, you know, let alone get into the mitochondria. It's got to penetrate the cell membrane. It's got to penetrate the mitochondrial cell membrane to get to where it needs to go. So your body makes it for you if you're getting exposed to near infrared radiation. And that's one of the reasons why I think most of us are well served if we live in warmer climates. And many of us can't for a wide variety of reasons. But if you're unable to, you can stimulate this by simple things like really high quality near infrared radiation bulbs. My favorite is a company called Sauna Space, because they have a very specific type of bulb that actually is almost identical to what the sun produces. Most infrared bulbs are producing about 15% near infrared. Their bulbs are producing 40%, which is you know pretty much precisely what the sun does. So, and then you can actually integrate them into a sauna, or you can like just put it on a light, especially in the winter. And because you said, well, I don't need it because I'm in an office or I'm in a building all day where I have all these windows. Windows block near infrared. It does not come through because almost by municipal building codes, you have to get an exclusion, but they all have this low E and these filters in the glass that prevent that from coming through. So you're not getting it. You have to be outside to get it or have special window glass, which virtually no one does. So that's or augment it with these types of bulbs. So that's one. The other thing is, and you know, it does is, you know, I'm sure you talk about testosterone being really important, and many men and women too are also low in testosterone. But guess what? Sun exposure does. It increases your testosterone level for free, no charge, no charge. It's crazy. So, I mean, it's just, and then nitric oxide, which is really important for optimizing. If you have high blood pressure, you know, increasing nitric oxide will cause your blood vessels to dilate, which helps lower your blood pressure. So sun exposure does that through both the UV and the infrared. And it makes structured water. I don't know if you've discussed or reviewed structured water before, but a lot of people drink it, but your body needs it to make it. It's kind of like structured water in your body is like a storage battery. It just builds up this energy that your body uses to make your blood flow through really tiny vessels like your capillaries. So
we need to find that for our audience, if you don't mind, Joe. Structured water.
Structured water is Gerald Pollack is the one that popularized it. He's got a book. He calls it Easy Water, which is E stands for exclusion zone water. He's a biophysicist out of the state of Washington. He's done a lot of the major research on water. And it's like the fourth phase of water was what he calls it. So it's like obviously a liquid, a solid, a gas. But this fourth phase, really, it's a phase of water where it's captured the energy that caused it to convert to structured water. And then your body can use this stored energy, really like a battery, to distribute it around primarily to move your blood through really tiny spaces. So, but it's really important. People drink it. I'm not a big fan of drinking it, although you could, it's not going to hurt you, but it's really important for your body to make it. And again, going back to the point, what did our ancestors do? Now, they didn't drink structured water. They might have if they got it from a spring, but it was, you know, wasn't consciously they were doing it, but they were outside all the time. And most of the time, and you know, we grew up in the subtropical, tropical areas. I mean, our ancestors did evolve from those areas. And that's what they were exposed to. So it seems sense that our biology, which changes very slowly, as most people understand, it doesn't change in decades or centuries, even it changes tens of thousands of years, even longer, for to get the unless you're doing genetic engineering, which we're both not fans of, I'm sure. But it changes slowly, and if we can take time to reflect on what the optimal circumstances were, our biology was designed for, and we can replicate that, we're going to optimize the intrinsic capacity our body has to become resilient, to obtain high levels of health. And we just knock out these barriers, and processed food being one of the biggest, you know, you knock that out. It's like impossible to get optimally healthy of eating processed foods. So those are two of the big ones for sure. NAD.
Yeah, exactly. That was just circling back to a lot of our audience is interested in NAD. Some people spend a large amount of money every month on NAD supplements to get to the mitochondria, like you say, you know, that are so essential for longevity and health. How do you feel about NAD supplements and their role?
Well, let's describe what NAD is first. I mean, when anyone who took biochemistry in college or med school will well recognize it in the Krebs cycle. It's been known, but it wasn't really until 2000 that David Sinclair, who's at MIT at the time in Leonard Gherardi's lab, discovered that NAD was actually a fuel. It's a molecule that's being used by your longevity proteins, your sirtuins. And if they don't have this fuel, they don't thrive. And your ability to achieve longevity is really radically diminished. So he popularized the notion that NAD is an important molecule that we need to pay attention to. The problem with it, NAD, and why there's so much confusion in this space, it's an unbelievably perishable molecule and incredibly difficult to assay. There's literally a handful of labs that can do it accurately. You have to be a research lab. And even if you are a research lab, you have to measure it. You have to go to the research lab and they have to draw the blood there and process especially. Otherwise, the measurement is invalid. It's a really hard molecule to measure. So as a result of that, people can't do all these studies to figure out these things. And, you know, it really limits the amount of knowledge that we have out there. But nevertheless, there are people who do it. And one of the people who's done some good work on it is Nicola Conlon. She's a molecular biologist out of the UK and came to the same conclusion I did, which is why I like her so much. But she figured out that these NAD precursors, as you mentioned, are very expensive. They could be at least 100 in most cases, and sometimes several hundred, maybe even more dollars every month, not a year, every month. So, and examples of those would be nicotinamide riboside, which became popular initially, and then more recently, nicotinamide mononucleotide, or NMN, which is what David Sinclair is promoting. What Nicola figured out was that your body actually recycles NAD. So you literally 95% of the NAD in your body is recycled. And so it made a lot more sense to look at your body's ability to regenerate that. And there's a specific enzyme called NAMPT that is the rate limiting enzyme, the bottleneck for producing NAD. So if you do steps to improve that, then what you can do is increase your NAD pretty dramatically. And one of the most important steps is time-restricted eating, and circadian rhythm optimization, because time-restricted eating and circadian rhythm optimization are integrally connected. So 90% of the people eat more than 12 hours a day, 90%. And I think it's like even higher levels if you're obese. It's crazy. They eat 15 to 16 hours a day. They're eating. The only time they're eating is when they're sleeping. So your body was not designed to do that. Ancestrally, we didn't do that. We went through periods of times for feasting and fasting. And most of us are not doing that today. So that disrupts when you're not having that restricted eating window of about 6 or 8 hours, which is ideal for most people, then you're going to disrupt your circadian rhythm. So that's one of the things that will also slow down the NAMPT enzyme that causes your body to make NAD. So if you do that thing and you exercise really good, especially when you're fasting, like the best time to exercise is in the morning. When you're fasting, you haven't eaten for maybe 16 hours or so. And then you throttle up this enzyme NAP is ready to just crank out NAD. And then the other thing we figured out is that a very small amount. See, when your body metabolizes NAD, that the sirtuins do, or the PARP proteins, they turn it into, they take NAD, it's converted to niacinamide, which is similar to niacin, but it's different. The niacinamide won't make you flush like niacin, but you need very tiny amounts of this niacinamide, because if you take a large amount, like 100 or 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams, that has a negative impact on your sirtuin proteins. There's a negative feedback loop that occurs there. It actually suppresses your, you know, it makes things worse. So we found out that like 50 milligrams for most people, which is, you know, again, not me. Typically most, you won't find niacinamide less than 500, but you can get it as a powder. If you get a powder, it's like a 1/64 of a teaspoon. You take that 3 times a day. That is usually, and usually that's probably, that is, if you're doing the time restricted eating, circadian rhythm optimization, which means, you know, well, I can address that, but then you're really going to activate your NAD, and it's going to cost you, I don't know if you're sitting down, $7 a year to do this. $7 a year, you know? So I just am passionate about finding simple, inexpensive, and preferably free ways that you can hack your way to health and prevent degenerative disease, avoid ever having to take a pharmaceutical. I think if you're taking a drug, I mean, you know, you want to find a clinician or a skilled clinician who understands these principles that can help walk you through and coach you through getting off of that drug. Because it's usually, I mean, there's some drugs where you may need it, you know, especially in autoimmune disease like thyroid medications and such, but or insulin if you're type 1 diabetic. But there's very few drugs that people really need to take. I mean, it's really the exception. And I'm not saying you should never use them. Clearly, they can be very helpful, but they're crutches. They're not the long-term solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They get at the symptoms.
Yeah. And thank God, your symptoms can be really debilitating. They could drive you to suicide. So yeah, they can be really helpful.
Right. Usually, Joe, at the end of our talks, we ask our speakers to give a few recommendations of what they suggest that would be helpful. But you've been doing that throughout our entire talk, which I greatly appreciate. You know,
I'm here to educate, inspire, and catalyze behavior so people can get healthy. You know, and it's been one of the greatest privileges of my clinical experience. You know, I transitioned out of seeing patients like 15 years ago, because I knew in my lifetime, 50,000, 100,000, if I was really lucky to treat that many patients, I've treated indirectly through my website across the world, 100 million people, 100, not treated, but provided information that's changed people's lives. And nothing gives me a greater thrill and joy to do that. Nothing.
Can you identify one or two exciting things happening in the longevity field outside of the work that you're doing?
That's an interesting question. I'd have to reflect on it. I'm intrigued with my email servers were hacked and I'm having to rely on webs. And I can't figure out how to turn off that beep. So I apologize. I do not do that by default. It's just, it's a temporary thing. So I apologize for that. And I should have closed that tab. The Yamanaka factors I find intriguing. Yamanaka got the Nobel Prize, I think, in 2012. And it's a series of genes that can be activated that essentially reverse the aging pretty incredibly. And there's complications with it. And I don't know that they'll be able to figure out in our lifetime, but that's intriguing. It's probably one of the more exciting components. And Sinclair's doing a lot of work on that, but I wouldn't be the first one to try it. That's for sure. I like something called V cells, which is, I believe, the best form of stem cells. I wouldn't do any other cells other than stem cells other than V cells, which is an acronym for very small embryonic-like stem cells. They're much smaller than stem cells. They're typically less expensive to get. You have an unlimited supply in your blood. They're autologous, which means you get them from your own body. You're not getting them from someone else like a donor, so you don't have any DNA mismatches. You have it's in your peripheral blood, so they don't have to do a fat biopsy to get them, or a bone marrow biopsy, or puncture. So it's a lot easier, and there's not many clinics that do that. There's probably only about a dozen or so, but it seems to be the ideal type of stem cell. So I think that type of thing is really important. And the other thing that's not really appreciated, I didn't have time to mention, was just draining your body of blood, because most all of us have too much iron. Almost everyone, if you're an adult, unless you're a heavily bleeding female, more than likely, 99% chance, you just have too much iron. And that causes enormous oxidative stress in your body, especially if you have anywhere near the type of linoleic acid consumption that most people do. And it's just a prescription for disaster. So, and we had that, and that's why I'm not surprised that we had such a radical reduction in lifespan in the last year. Yeah. With the accelerated catalyst of the COVID jab, because people were sitting duck waiting to get damaged for this stuff because of the practices they were engaging in that just essentially destroyed their resiliency.
Yeah, your point about the transfusion or the giving blood is so fascinating. You know, we all remember
donation.
Yeah, we all remember parabiosis and that, and now paper just came out where all you do is
that's another exciting blood. Actually the parabiosis would be, we can pretty much achieve the same benefits with something called plasmapheresis, and I think that, thank you for reminding me, because I think that may be one of the most exciting components that's readily available, still pretty pricey, but holds a lot of promise, plasmapheresis, because in the parabiosis it's not so much that they're adding new things from the younger mice, they're taking out the junk from your body, and that's what plasmapheresis can do.
Yeah, that's such an exciting area. As far as you hinted at with the iron, giving blood,
donating blood.
Yeah. What does that look like? Donate once a month, or what's, depends on the person.
Well, there's virtually no one that could donate once a month because that's 500 cc's. That's 10% of your blood supply. Right. So usually, four times a year is quite a bit. That's probably, most people wouldn't hardly even be able to do that, but at least twice a year, four times a year. Now, what I do for Optimize is I believe so strongly in this. And plus I have, my dad had hemochromatosis because I have a genetic anemia called beta thalassemia. So I get a tendency to have higher iron. So I typically draw my blood and take out 60 cc's of blood every week, which equates to about 7 units of blood a year. So that's a pretty rapid way to get rid of it for me. And I said, I'm committed to that. Most of us aren't going to draw our own blood and take out, you know, 2 ounces of blood a week, but that would be, in my view, ideal. You could do it less frequently. So you can do like 2 times 4 is 8. So you can do 8 ounces of blood once a month. And if you do it slower, it's more tolerated. You just can't do 500 cc's once a month. You could do it once or twice, but the third time they're not, your hemoglobin's gonna be, because it takes you 3 months to regenerate your blood. 3 months.
Yeah. Wow, this has been so fascinating. There's so many things that we haven't even had a chance to cover. How can people find out more about the work you're doing on your website? Maybe you could repeat it for people that are listening to this on audio.
It's my last name, Mercola, MERCOLA.com. As I alluded to earlier, my site was a treasure trove of information, but we had to delete our articles. And now our articles are only up for 48 hours, and then we transfer them to our Substack site. So, which is, you just substack.com and type in Mercola, it'll come right up. So, and because of the position that I've taken in embracing the responsibility of educating people about the dangers of what's been happening in the last 2 years that the media isn't exposing. So I've been vilified and deplatformed essentially everywhere. So well, off of YouTube, we actually sued YouTube just a few weeks ago for doing what they did, because they changed the rules without telling us, and because we had no checks or violations. We had no violations and none, zero. And they just changed the rules and they said, you're gone. Because we never put stuff up that violated their terms. We wouldn't want to do that, you know, because it's an important platform, but they control the system. So anyway, the reason I've alluded to that is not to brag, but to just mention that you're not really going to find me. I think we're on Facebook and Twitter, but we have no reach on there at all. So, but you could, if you go to those, you might find us. So yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of, and I've written 17 best-selling books, so those are out there too.
We appreciate all you're doing to help people in their quest for greater health. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're most welcome. I'm just delighted to have the opportunity to share some of this really important information.
This is for general information and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to constitute or substitute for medical advice or counseling. The practice of medicine or the provision of healthcare, diagnosis, or treatment, or the creation of a physician, patient, or clinical relationship. The use of this information is at their own user's risk. If you find this to be on the value, please hit that like button to subscribe to support the work that we do on this channel. And we take your suggestions and advice very seriously, so please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we hope to see you next time.